the listeners of Unreal Bluegrass, my next guest. I know that if you follow Bluegrass Americana roots music, you know of him by name and you know of his work. He is a very, very experienced author. He writes books and articles, and he's a broadcaster. And I want to get into those things with him, but I know Craig from really running past him at different events. But Craig Havinghurst, I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. Yeah. Listen, I want to flesh out some of your credentials. At the top of the show, I mentioned a little bit about some of the things you've done. You're an author of a book that has a great place in history of music, especially with radio, Air Castle of the South, WSM, and The Making of Music City. That's a very revered text book that you wrote. I know that you write articles. You had articles in the Wall Street Journal, Acoustic Guitar, which is my favorite guitar magazine, No Depression. I think the audience knows who you are, whether they know it was really you or not.
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit about fill in some on what you've been doing? It doesn't have to be everything.
Sure.
We know you've been on radio, but I just kind of want to open this up, be real informal with you.
Yeah, what's different about my world in the last 3 to 4 years is I've had a steady job at a place that is, you know, where I'm running the music news at WMOT Roots Radio out of Nashville, Murfreesboro. It's on the campus of Middle Tennessee State University. It's a Roots Americana format that we launched just about 4 years ago this fall. And, you know, I had been freelancing for so long before that as multimedia, because writing was one piece of it, but hard to sustain as just a print writer alone. So I did radio reporting and for the local public radio station here, the news station WPLN, and then for NPR some features, and wrote pieces for a variety of outlets. But I did a lot of video and filmmaking, and a lot of my work in bluegrass, some of the most exciting things I've been involved in my life were bluegrass film projects, a lot of press kit stuff for Rounder. We did a road film with the Infamous String Dusters some years ago, and I worked on I directed and produced the videos at the museum, the Earl Scruggs Museum in Shelby, North Carolina,
sure.
my home state. And so it was a variety. But lately, I pretty much host the talk show on WMOT called The String, interviews with artists and creators and sometimes authors, and produce news pieces through the week as they come up. And we're working on our year-end wrap-up stories and our best albums list. And that's been my really exclusive focus here for 4 years.
And that's really why, Craig, when I made the comment that if they don't think they know you, they knew, because you've done so many things, contributed as an observer and a recorder of music and the culture around it. I'm certain, and you just rattled off a few of those things, I'm certain that the audience here knows who you are and what you've accomplished, and it's a very high caliber. Well, it's a very high caliber. I know who you are. We were talking off the air. I've run across you several times, probably in Raleigh, more than any place else during the IBMA week down there. And
Didn't miss it for the world, except we had to miss it for the world.
Except
didn't
everybody did this year. Yeah, what a shame. And let's save that thought for a minute, because there's been this incredible impact on the entire world. But as far as this radio program goes and what your work does, we've seen an amazing, profound impact on music and music venues and how people are restructuring their lives, not only how artists, but how audience have to retrain themselves to be audience members.
That's a good point. That's absolutely true.
Yeah. We've witnessed major tours just stop dead. I remember it was a Friday. You remember this? I think it was probably in March or late February, where everything kind of shut down all at once in 2020. And major tours they turned around and went back home. And you've talked to them, I've talked to them, and as the progression goes, you know, it's like there's kind of just don't know what to do next. They're going to, you know, they're going to try to do this, but then they get to be a little bit better at producing themselves, and people started doing things in their home, artists did, and trying to find an audience there with performances. And you know this technical end much better, but they've developed so many different ways to produce it and I guess make live videos if you want to discuss it, but it's been a horrible effect on music and the venues and the audiences, because we need to be part of the feedback as much as artists need to be the person getting it back. But your observations on that, if you wouldn't mind.
The thing that stands out for me is the resilience of the artists. I'm sure we don't get to talk to them in their darkest downer moments, which I'm sure they have. We all have. We've all grieved for the world and for the status of the country and for jobs and for venues at various times. But when you as I've pursued these relationships and listen to artists talk and let them talk, there's still this great spirit of, this will get past. We will get past it. We're figuring out. We're learning new skills. And sometimes some of them are about production and making recordings at home or making good quality video to stream or coming up with an economic model for monetizing their performance. Some are playing every day. There's a cat in Charlotte who gets on every afternoon at the same time, plays for a couple hours, has a huge Facebook following, and it's been that kind of, and those stories of success ripple through the community and inspire others. And I just haven't yet talked to a musician who leaves me feeling down about the situation. People are trying to, they're renewing their relationships with their family. Whatever it is, they're finding something constructive, creative ways to spend the time and keeping their spirits up. Winter is going to be hard, and we're at a stage where some of the venues that we've been looking at on kind of in a suspenseful way may actually start to really close for good. And some have, I think a couple dozen are listed in the latest Billboard survey around the country. But here in Nashville, things are, people are hanging on, and there are continue to be programs to preserve that infrastructure. So when folks go back to work, there's a place to work and a lot of support systems, a lot of organizations supporting them. But I've just been really struck by the spirit.
Well, I think you hit on it there. There's a tremendous resilience of the artists. And if you back it up a little bit, almost all of them would tell you their entire life was toward being an artist. I mean, some of them got into it later, but they all kind of knew they had to do that, and they had the skill, and they wanted to perform. So even in the time, and the horrible coincidence, and I'm not comparing this absence of venues or where people can perform work and watch them with what's happening on a global scale or a national scale as far as the health but right in the middle of, as we're all watching for ways to deliver the recorded sound. Let's assume the pandemic didn't happen in 2020 in the beginning. We were already struggling with how do we get the sound to the customers? How do we get it to the radio stations? There were things developing all the time as, how long are CDs going to be available? Certainly artists sell them at venues, which is a double whack because they don't have any place to play right now. But the music as a whole was just being... I guess it's because of the streaming. I guess it's because of the way that people listen to music now. But on top of how do they get their product and how do they move it at merch tables, it was getting harder and harder. You can't even – well, here's a good example. You can't even buy a car now with a CD player in it. So what's going to happen to the recorded music? And now the performances are just being – they're shut down.
Yeah, I'm a little more bullish on the music economy COVID notwithstanding, about the critique of streaming royalties is real and legitimate to a point, but I still see a lot. Most of the tone of that conversation has come from some legacy artists who used to make bank on radio when radio was the sole way that people discovered music, and they got used to a royalty structure. And then when they see that, as they get older, their catalog shifts to the streaming. And, well, frankly, they're not getting played or heard by as many ears. And so a fraction of a penny for a single listen doesn't seem like much. It's a third of a penny, roughly. But when you actually add it up, a song that actually becomes a true hit and that is equivalent of a number one song back in 1990 or 1980 still makes a good amount of money. And then there are these fascinating evolving platforms where people can be more direct about their commerce. And I think the main one is Bandcamp. And I've spent a lot of time this year browsing Bandcamp and using that platform as a fan and using it to express my interest in artists by buying their recordings there, they're buying their digital recordings, and in many cases buying LPs and CDs through them. They are a merch store, a hard goods store. in addition to being a digital download store. And it's a free-for-all of artistry. It's just vast. And people have to remember that in the old thing, first thing you learn in the first day of economics is supply and demand. And demand is robust for music. I think it should be bigger for good music and the music that we love in Roots in Americana. It's grown. It's strong. But what's really grown is the supply. The number of artists out there vying for the attention and the bandwidth of the American mind has just exploded. It's an order of magnitude over what it was in the 80s or 90s. For a variety of reasons. It's easier to make a recording. People have encouraged young right. people to chase their dreams. Bluegrass brings in new artistry with it. It trains their young. It brings them up in a culture of picking and performing. And so we would love to see all of the talent get expressed as successful careers. I don't think that was ever a realistic thing. And people are vying for a constrained, you know, in a very tight marketplace. That's just realistic.
Well, I think go ahead.
So and finally, when I look at the robust festival infrastructure and the number of talented bands in bluegrass, especially, who rely absolutely on live performance for a living, both the fees they make at the gigs and then the merch they sell, I'm still buying CDs. Bought one just yesterday, and I think that many people do, and they figure out ways to convert their talent into dollars, and I see it happening. And so COVID busted up a bunch of experiments and a bunch of growth and evolution in that.
That's a great way to put it. You made 2 points I want to circle back to. The number of radio outlets, and you mentioned the fact that was sort of in your change, in your discussion of the change of how people hear things, that plays on the radio don't exist for a number of reasons. Number one, it's probably the programming. And number two, I think above that is there just aren't that many radio stations that aren't controlled, that aren't talk radio. I don't mean control, but, you know, have programming pushed into them, whether right. it's talk radio, which has no music at all, or some other. But there's the radio outlets for Roots, Americana, Bluegrass are shrinking all the time.
Yeah, it's unbelievable to be part of a radio station at MTSU that decided to switch its format and upgrade its transmitter and aggressively go into the marketplace as a music-forward independent radio station.
That's great.
It's like, wow, that rarely, you know, that's it's kind of a miracle. So we're hanging in there and doing pretty well.
Well, and thank God they are. I mean, it takes a huge commitment, and they got to be in it for a long haul. They're not going. I don't think they're going to show. Well, I don't know, but I don't think they're going to have immediate results on things that on counters that they can bank, that they can look at ratings. I think they're going to have to be in it for the long haul to bring in more people, because there's going to be people looking for it. And now the other thing is too. You know, of course, you have your broadcast tower. And you have more power there, but everything is online to be accessed on radio stations.
Well, we do both, right?
Yeah,
we
sure.
simulcast on the web, and we produce shows that go out as podcasts, and we keep up with we're trying to keep up with all the media that is.
The you also mentioned this, and you hit it right on the nail. The number of bands. There are so many incredibly great. Every time, Craig, if you just tune in, I'm talking to Craig Havinghurst, who has a lot of knowledge and a lot of experience, and I'm going to pick as much of it as I can. Every time you go to, let's say, just a music festival in general, don't you always find they could be a young band, they could be a restructuring of other artists and older bands, mm-hmm. but you always find someone you think, how did I miss this? How have I never heard about this? And they're phenomenal.
Yeah, that's why this is fun.
It is fun. You go someplace and you walk away saying, I got to find out who these people are. I got to contact them. I got to find out where I can get their music. So and there's so many of them that are so talented. And you have like where you are now, the schooling. Mm-hmm. You have Berkeley. You have several colleges that actually offer programs.
ETSU literally just trains bluegrass and old-time musicians.
So, and they're coming out. The thing about them is I used to call, only because I didn't want to list every college in the description, I used to talk about the Berkeley effect, meaning that mm-hmm. Berkeley would find these great young talents and kind of bring them up for a summer and look at them, and then they would be attending Berkeley, and they would be great technical musicians, and they would come out of that college and other colleges also with all this incredible music theory that, you know, you can sit on your porch and play and be really, really great, but all of a sudden you have these other things in your head about where the chords are and where the melody should go and what you can do with a song, and all of a sudden they're just you just sit in amazement at what these kids, to me they're kids, can come out of college and what they can produce, and they're not only so efficient technically, mentally they're places where I have to really struggle to try to figure out what they're doing, but I know it's great.
Yeah, I've been fond of the band Hawktail here in Nashville.
Oh yeah, sure.
Who all of whom had formal training at one place or another, and who think with incredible harmonic sophistication, and yet then on bluegrass instruments they compose, they improvise. It's a hybrid sound, and it's in a kind of a progressive bluegrass, newgrass, acoustic tradition, but they really have a lot of room to invent and grow, and they are just gorgeous and fascinating. And I grew up in a household, my first music I was exposed to was classical music, and formal violin lessons as a kid, and then discovered jazz as a teenager. So my first music, I didn't discover roots music and folk music or really get into it, knew what it was, but get into it until I was about 19 or 20 years old. So every time I see artists that blend those worlds and that draw from jazz and draw from classical and know how to play with harmony and more sophisticated layering and orchestration, I get really excited.
You mentioned jazz, which I'm a big fan of jazz. Probably my first love in high school, once I got rid of the rock, only because the stations changed, I found jazz by myself. I was literally driving down the road and I found the local jazz station and I thought, this is what I want to hear. And I started learning and going, you could go to record stores then and read the back of, you know, Lynyrd Feather's liner notes, and you could read who was playing on what and get all that stuff. I feel like, and I love it. I love jazz. I absolutely do. And people who listen to this show know that it sneaks in through different people who interpret jazz standards. And I like it. But I think at some point, it's not just a band that did it, but at some point to me, the very top innovative players, and they don't have to be progressive. They can just be really, really talented, and you know their mind is there. They cross over easy. Jazz and bluegrass, at that highly technical skill, they're really doing – they have different chords, and they have different ways of playing things, but the mastery is the same. And I've always felt that at the top level that jazz and bluegrass went back and forth. And the first album that blew my mind that proved it to me was good old Slim Ritchie out there with Ridge Runner Records. He had Jazzgrass, and that was the first time. And David Grisman started playing jazz, and I thought, that's exactly it. They have to have the chops to get there, but it's an easy transition if you want to. You don't have to, but to me, the two musics were the two types were so similar, and I think that if you put them in the same room at that level, I think they'd get along great and have a great time playing music.
Yeah, absolutely. I pointed out once in an article that bluegrass and bebop were born at exactly the same time in history in two different cities with musicians that had their own traditions, but they were both doing very much the same thing, where there was individual virtuosity in the band that was showcased, but there was a band consciousness as well. It was a product of the post-war boom in America, but they were, you know, bebop and bluegrass have a lot in common. You put me in mind of the great Andy Statman, who I got to interview within the past year, and that was a real treat for me. Somebody I'd wanted to talk to for a long time, and you know, he was picking hardcore bluegrass in the folk boom of the 1950s in New York and Greenwich Village, and now he's capable of anything, including straight up avant, you know, out there avant garde music. So.
And he's still doing it. He's still doing it. He's coming back in a band. I only know this because of a good friend. Well, a good friend plays in the band with me. Mark Horowitz is someone that I've gotten very familiar with. And Andy's playing great. But it's funny, when you find one of his records, you have to be, if you want to play it on the air, you need to listen to the entire song unless your audience is ready for it, because he can start out right down the middle, and all of a sudden he's out in Sun Ra territory, and it's kind of like, how do we pull this back in before the? But that's exactly, you're making the point that I'm making, and I think you have maybe a greater understanding of it than I do. But that's always been my connection to both music, both forms of music has always been that level, and it doesn't have to be unrecognizable. It doesn't have to be something that you have to struggle to find the melody or the tempo.
Exactly right.
They're great, and they love each other's music also. I mean, you know, Bill Keith, how many great jazz classics did Bill Keith reinvent on the banjo? And whether people know it or not, they may not know it, but they're listening to jazz standards, but listen to Bill on the banjo, they think it may be a bluegrass tune.
I just changed the theme song on my show because I rotated out about every 8 or 9 months just for variety's sake, the opening theme, and I went with the track by Jake Sheps, who is yes. a banjo player out in Boulder, who is pursuing just a wonderful variety of sounds, including a neoclassical and yep. doing Eric Satie with chamber group. And, you know, it's when she starts to run down that road, there is a lot. There is a lot. In fact, it's a book to be written, but nobody pays anybody to write books anymore. So that would be one that I would love to do.
You need one of those grants. You need yeah. one of those grants.
One
of those
GoFundMe.
Yeah. Or maybe someday you can get a government. I don't know where that would be anymore, though, but we'll have to wait for the times to reoccur.
It's not out of the question.
It's not out of the question. Yeah, that'd be great. I know Jake. I know his music, and I've played it on the air, but he does everything. You're right. He kind of collects everything together, and there's other people that do that, too. But when I mentioned the few that I didn't mean to be exclusive at all. There's so many of them.
Oh, we could go on and on.
Forever
That's
and ever.
The beauty of it.
If you wanted to start with Newgrass Revival, if you want to go as far as the most obvious – and they took it a little further, and then Bela came in and everything. But, I mean, there's a huge river that flows from all of that, and it's not that far from really what was being done in the 60s and what people now consider standard bluegrass. I mean, listen, when J.D. and the New South came out, you know, that famous album that we all love and die for, some of that was not received that well because of where they chose their music from. People, you know, so I remember when it came out and it was like incredible playing, but
the song repertoire,
right. They're pulling in songs like, well, that's not, well, now that's regarded as the highest mark you can reach. Well, at the time it was great music, but there were still old school, I don't mean old people, but there's still old school people who didn't like where they pulled music from. And there's other bands that have done that too, and you know that.
Wasn't it interesting, Steve, that the Newgrass Revival went into the Hall of Fame this fall?
Yeah,
the Bluegrass Hall of Fame, and you didn't hear a peep about that being a controversial call.
Nope.
It was an absolute consensus choice, and it was inevitable that it happened. I'm glad it happened when everybody was, you know, in the prime of their career and life, and doing great work. Sometimes Hall of Fame inductions come to later than you'd like, but this was a great one, and everybody was, you know, stood and cheered.
And 30 years after their last performance.
Yeah.
And that blows my mind because, first of all, I just realize how much older I am every time I think about that. Because they were, you know, the guys, and you know, they showed up, and they kind of looked like hippies, but they could always play. Nobody doubted they could play, but and they finally quit. And 30 years later, there's no complaint about the fact that, yeah, they're one of the best ever, and they belong in the Hall of Fame. I agree with you. I'm thrilled. So often, how many times do artists get it, you know, after or while they're almost gone, which is a sad, sad thing. But those guys get to enjoy all that, partly because they started so young and made such a big impact. But it was a great choice. I was absolutely ecstatic over it. So right now you're talking about doing a year in, which I've never done one of those. And if you're tuning into Unreal Bluegrass right now, this fellow you know, you may know him directly by his name, but you know the work that he's done. Craig Havinghurst has done everything as far as roots music, written journal articles, written books, does a regular radio show, and is all over it much more than I ever am. But you mentioned that you're doing a kind of a year-end review. How is that affected by not being able to go see these artists as new recordings come out from your point of view?
It's a fascinating question, actually. I think that, you know, you realize that as the year comes to the close that you have not given every record an equal opportunity to and listened to it in the same way, in a scientific way. So certain records catch you. You know, I know the records better and deeper and have more fondness for the records that were artists that I interviewed during the year than artists that I didn't, right? And despite similarly, getting to the right show at the right time would affect the way I heard the record and could induce me to, you know, elevate that record in the year end. We don't call it a best of. I resist that. I don't have any trouble with people that do ranked lists, but we at WMOT don't do what we call it is essential, outstanding and essential albums.
Okay.
Meaning there may be a storyline connected to a record that puts it in our top, and we do 30 titles. And it may not be a record that was, you know, on its own aesthetically the greatest thing that ever was, but it has a tale,
good,
a reason to be. Or it might be a really important debut. And so there's other criteria, but I think that not catching live shows is definitely affecting the way we hear it, but you'll never know what you're missing,
exactly,
or what changed, right?
Yeah, there's no way to tell because you weren't there, but you're right. You're always in the past. If you go see a band and they have a new piece of music out and it's good, when you see them do it and they do it really well, it sinks in more. It just makes a bigger impact. So, and I wonder too about that with the annual awards, and I'm thinking more about IBMA. You have Performers of the Year, you have Songs of the Year, from people that for the most part no one has seen perform those songs. There are great bands out there this year that were up for all sorts of nominations that nobody had ever seen live. I mean, there just were. It's like, well, it'd be nice if they could have, and they were planning a big release. And they would be, I'm not going to name names, they're planning a big tour behind it, and there was no way to do it. Just all of a sudden, everything was knocked out from underneath them. And I hope that they stay together and get to where they can go back out sometime next year, hopefully in 2021, and get behind their new albums, although they're still releasing albums now. That would be the hardest thing, I think. You're a musician, you've put all this stuff, months and months in the studio putting an album out, and your release date happens to be after the time that everything is shut down. Well, what do you hold back? Do you release it to? How do you get the publicity to release it? You're not out beating the band at concerts and making things available on the table, which I think is where they probably sell the most anymore, is off of the merchandise table at shows.
Sure. Well, you know, you raise a point that I've been on a soapbox about this year, which is that I think that the audience owes the musicians a sort of reclaiming and reasserting their interest and their focus on recorded music, which means start with looking at your audio system. What do you actually listen to these records
good,
on?
Yeah, good.
And I've always taken some pride in my hi-fi this year more than ever, and I've taken more pleasure in it this year more than ever because I made an upgrade and an investment in it last winter. But, like, starting with that, and then who's reminding the audience to buy the records that they stream most often and fall in love with on the streaming services? Occasionally hear an artist urge that on Twitter. I did a story about this earlier this year as Record Store came around, and the ethos of buy what you love after you discover what over the streaming. You know, stream to discover, buy what you fall in love with. There is a moral onus on the audience. And then if you buy that record, don't listen to it over, on iTunes on your headphones,
right,
on earbuds. Give yourself the chance to hear sonically what's really there, the levels, the depth, the soundstage, the width. We're Gary Pachos is a hero of mine and of all of us who love great music. He's recorded so many amazing acoustic records and works with Rounder Records, and I think the record, if I had to pick a record of the year, Katie Pruitt's Expectations, not a bluegrass project, but a brilliant folk rock record, it just earned a Grammy nomination for Best Engineering. Like, well, no surprise, it was Gary, you know.
Good.
But it sounds so stunning on a system. And hey, y'all, take a favorite record and go to the last remaining hi-fi store in your town and say, play this for me on a system, and just, you don't have to walk out with it, but do yourself a favor of realizing what it is you're missing at home if you don't
have a setup. That's a great point, because so many of them, I mean, I don't do it necessarily. I do have a daughter that everything is in her ears, and I don't know what she's hearing, but I know it's a smaller frequency than what I'm hearing, a smaller range. It's just more compressed. But you make a great point about you owe it to yourself, you owe it to the artist. You owe it to the artist to support them in this time.
That's exactly what
you have to do. You have to find and buy the music. Because if you don't, some of them can't pull it out for next year. I mean, some of them are
now more than ever.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's a great bumper sticker that we can bring out too. Let me ask you this: you mentioned LPs. What's your comparison? and I don't mean to open up a topic we can't possibly handle, but vinyl is great. It's fun to buy vinyl. It's fun to listen to vinyl. And I know that people get excited that, hey, the number of recordings of vinyl has gone up X percent, but I think yep. they need to put it in perspective that the number of total recordings has gone down so much that that's not that big of a number, but it's great to be able to get one. And I still struggle with the sound on an LP versus a CD. I really think that the LP is more personal, but I don't know what that means. What do you think about those things?
Yeah, it's a large ethos question. It's a whole sort of spirit. It is more difficult to get the very best quality sound out of an LP through a stereo system. It's harder than queuing up a CD, or the turntable is more finicky. It's a little harder to know what where to find your value for your buck. They're fairly expensive as components go. They're on the more expensive end. You know, you want to get in for $500-$700, and people are like, we're a little reluctant to do that and to start collection. But there's also pretty cool systems that are a turntable and two powered speakers right. with a built-in amplifier that are pretty affordable. And then once you get on the flywheel starts to spin and you cherish your vinyl and you start to make it, you get used to the ritual of putting it on and flipping the record, it becomes pretty infectious. I go through phases with vinyl where I listen to it pretty concentratedly, and then I'll switch back to digital. And I switched to Tidal last couple of months, the higher resolution streaming service. And it's pretty extraordinary. The minimum that they stream at is a CD quality, and then many titles are higher quality than that, sort of at the level that they mixed the record in. That makes a difference. That sounds to me like that's the optimal playback to me, is that either CD quality, digital. But records are lovely and wonderful, and I try to collect them based on sentimental value of a recording.
Well, that's where I'm going. That's where I'm going.
The three or four new releases of a year that I think are most sonically sumptuous, yeah. I look around to try to buy on vinyl. And
that's kind of where I was going. You're headed that way a little bit, but is it just because we grew up doing that, and you flip it over, you're more involved because you can't listen to 75 minutes without moving. You got to get up and move it over and turn it over, mm-hmm. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's just that emotional attachment that I still have to vinyl. And I don't listen to near as much as I do of CDs because they're harder. And when I was doing the radio show for Jazz in Cincinnati, I couldn't. We had two turntables and a microphone, just like the song. But I took my old vinyl there, but it was so much easier to put the CDs in. Now a lot of radio programs are just going from computers, and I understand that too. It's another step of convenience if you have to go in and program.
And you got to clean the records, folks. Yes. You got to have a good record cleaner, a good brush, and the fluid. And you got to do the little cleaning, and that you'll be amazed. And you got to clean your needle every now
that's
and again.
Right.
It's higher maintenance.
It is higher maintenance. It's higher maintenance.
You get
it's
out what you put in.
That's exactly right. Well, and you remember as well as I, and what you still do, and I still do, where you'd buy those little kits and you'd have the little put the fluid on there, and you just it was almost like an act of love where you would go around and get all the dust out of your things, and then blow that off and turn it over. And God forbid if we went back to the days when, and I'm probably older than you, where we stacked them up. You'd find you'd stack up five and they'd just fall down and scratch around and fall down, and you flip the whole bunch over again. And how those ever survived, they have a lot of surface noise on them now, but that's the way we used to do it before we found that we had to do it with loving care. And it definitely worked. I used to buy vinyl and just immediately record it on the best cassette that I could, and then I'd put it back in the sleeve and never touch it again. Just leave it over there in the purest form that I could find. Well, this has been, I've always wanted to chat with you, and I'm so glad you were available to do it. You have so much history and so much of a broader view, and I will classify you as an observer and reporter of all things going on in music right now.
Oh, thanks. That's a lovely way to make it, and I feel that way.
I appreciate the fact that you're out there doing it, and maybe someday, Craig, we'll run into each other again when the halls open up and the venues open up and we can all go. It's going to happen, but I mean, I don't know when. None of us do, but we just have to be careful in the meantime, and we'll chat. Someday we'll chat in person looking at each other, which I hate the fact that so much of this program has to be done without seeing someone, because you don't have that connection with them. It works, but it works so much better if you're sitting there eyeballing some. I'm sure you feel the same way about field recordings and recordings that you do in the studio. If you can see them, you kind of get where things are going, and so much of this is done essentially blind, I guess you'd say, but we have to listen that much harder to pick up what's going on.
Yep, that's the one thing. That's the way I make up for it, is close my eyes, really try to picture being there. Yeah. And I found it was working both ways. I've done a lot of Zoom interviews this year, but also quite a few phoners. And I take what I can get, and I take each one from its own. I often ask if I'm talking to somebody on the phone, like I did today, an artist who lives down in southern Georgia. I was like, just tell me where you're sitting. What do you see? Yeah. What's special about that place? And it leads to something else. So.
I like it, and I'm going to let you go. I don't have other things to do. But recently it was triggered off in my mind, my memory about the Newgrass Revival. The first person I could contact that I knew well enough immediately was I called Pat Flynn. So we're doing a show with Pat right as they were announced. And I keep hearing this sound in the kitchen. I can even see it in my meter. And if people are bored, just put up with me for a minute. So you can see more sounds than you can hear on the radio because you have all these little recording levels. And I'm thinking, what is he doing? I finally said, Pat, are you out walking? Yeah, I'm out walking my dog in the woods. I said, would you stop for just a second so that we can finish it? Because I hear every step you're taking now. Thinking back, it's kind of cool. It's kind of a cool ambience. I mean, I like that. I like it when people are out by water or a dog is barking. It's their dog. I don't care. I have a dog that barks. But he kept walking through the woods, and I kept him every step.
Oh, my God. I would try to guess who did that, yeah. Not optimal for the
No, it makes it hard, but it makes it more like you're in person. But all those things you have to take in, and technical failures and all those other things. But you do a great job. I appreciate your availability and your willingness to discuss with me and we have to limit ourselves. We can think about the bigger picture, but for what we're doing now, we have to think about the impact on music as we know it and as the audience knows it. And I appreciate you sharing your views on that, what kind of a year this has been. It's not over yet, but it's close.
Well, I wish you well, Steve. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you, sir. Take care of yourself. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks again, Craig Havinghurst, for sharing all of your insight based on a lot of observation. There's a lot going on in Craig's world, and he's looking at it all, and he's bringing it all back to us, and I enjoyed every second of it. Thank you, Craig Havinghurst,